Steve, the tape recording system is officially on?
We're on the record.
Okay.
You know, no one's called in. Maybe we should just kill it.
Is Patricia calling?
Okay. Well, good morning.
Nobody has.
Thank you, everyone, for taking time out of your busy schedule on a beautiful Friday morning to be with us this morning. I'll give you the good news and the bad news. The bad news is that we're here. The good news is that we were going to try to do this at the racetrack, but we thought about it and said that probably would be in bad form, and somebody somewhere in the food chain would take exception to us doing that. So just understand that there was a good thought along the way, and you'll be out in time to go to OTB and place a bet on the Blue Jays if we have time. So we'll consider ourselves a call to order. We will have a motion to approve the consent agenda. Is there a motion?
Motion made.
Second.
Are there any items that anyone would like to take off of the consent agenda and discuss specifically? Seeing none, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, carried unanimously, and I will turn it over to Robert for the report of the president.
Thank you very much, Michael, and good morning to everyone that I haven't seen over the summer months. I certainly appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedules to be here to participate in this council's meeting. First of all, I'd like to just continue to thank each and everyone for all that you do for this university as we continue on our quest to move this university to the next level of excellence. And I think you've heard me say more time than once that what we're trying to do here, if you sit and think about it, you'll be able to see quite clearly that the ambitious agenda that we put forward for the University of Albany, if we're able to move all of these initiatives forward, and even if we're only to move half of them, will probably be the biggest and the largest academic expansion of this university since this campus was built in the late 1960s. And folks, I tell you, that makes us very, very excited. Hopefully you're very, very excited, and hopefully you're helping us to carry the message out across the state and across these multiple communities about how important this university is and how important this ambitious vision that we've articulated for this university, how important that is for the long-term success and vitality of this universe, but also how critically important that the status quo is not adequate. It won't get us where we need to be. So we have no choice but to try to expand this university in very thoughtful, but also in very, very strategic ways that it will continue to serve as a resource for the citizens of the state of New York. So we're very, very excited about that. And so what I want to do today in my report is to focus on what I think are two main aspects of that expansion. And that is to kind of give you an update first on some of the operational and facility activities and changes and initiatives that are underway, and to kind of give you an update on some of those. And then secondly, to talk a little bit more and give you an update on several of the strategic initiatives that are a critical component of our efforts to expand the academic scope of this university. And I want to start with the first kind of operational issue, because I know some of you may have questions and may have want a little clarity about the leadership transitions that you've probably been hearing about somewhat sporadically in the last 2.5 years since I've been here. And so to kind of put it all in one place, I've asked my staff to develop this color-coded R chart that kind of gives you a pretty good perspective on the changes that have been made in the last 2.5 years. And let me say on the front end, the majority of these changes were initiated by folks coming to me at least a year in advance, or in some cases a few months in advance, and indicating their desire to transition to retire because they felt it was time for them to think about going back to the faculty or doing something different, or there were extenuating family circumstances that precipitated some of these. But the rest were done under my prerogative as president of this university to think about the leadership team and to make sure we had the right people in the right places to really move this university forward. And so you can see that the yellow or people that basically have been hired in the 2.5 years that I've been here, both across my direct report portfolio as well as the ones that report to a person who's also a relatively new hire, been here
7 months now, 8 months, or something like that?
Working on seven. Working on 7 months. Jim Stellar, our provost, who I thank you all have a chance to meet. Yes.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Yeah.
Apparently Joe Garba is on the line now. So maybe if we can get that link established. So I'm going to put this on pause for a second, if I might.
All right. Most of these positions were filled via competitive. There were a couple that are on here that we decided that that it wasn't prudent to do a search, and we made some internal hires. One is an external hire without a search. But most of these had a very rigorous search process as a part of it. And we're very, very pleased with people that we're bringing on. And I can tell you, a lot of what you see here was actually done within the last 12 months. We must have been running somewhere between 8 to 10 searches last academic year. And I wouldn't advise anyone to try that again. It was a monumental task that really took a lot of time. But I'm very, very pleased to report in each and every one of those searches that we ran last year, we were able to recruit our first choice almost in every one of them. And when we couldn't get our first choice, we decided to delay and do the search later. But I wanted to emphasize that because my sense is that at this university in the past, we kind of had to settle sometime for second and third choices, particularly for some of our academic searches. And the fact that we were able to recruit people in parallel positions at other universities to transfer to come here speaks volumes, I think, about the compelling vision and the prospects of excellence that this university is starting to put forward. And I just don't want to lose sight of that, because I can tell you, we had some amazing candidates, and we're very, very pleased with the results of the searches we ran. And you'll have an opportunity to meet the newest member of this entering class in just a few moments as I move along with this report. But if you have any specific questions about this, I'd be very, very happy to answer any questions. But just wanted you to see the changes in leadership that we've made, and just to talk about that for a bit.
Mr. President, just a quick comment and just accolade. I mean, as I count this, I see 13 direct reports to you, if I'm following the maps here.
Well, not 13, but if you, because the deans report to the provost, so if you...
I was just covering the top boxes there. I was just commenting
you
that...
Mean total, yes.
Total. I think that's, you know, that's great. Yeah. That's a sign of a hands-on leader, and a lot of corporations will have, you know, stops in between there just because of that, but I love that you have that open door and have that door in direct line. Everyone can come to see the boss if they need to.
Right. And a couple of the things that are in those boxes are temporary or, you know, not permanent positions. They are positions that we done put in place to take care of particular strategies that we needed someone to wake up each and every day thinking about. Case in point, Sue Phillips's position for strategic partnerships, that's because of the discussions we were having around all of these partnerships, and I needed someone to spend their full time focusing on that, so that's a temporary position. As well as the other red box that you see up there for, we hope at some point, if we build capacity, this may evolve into a permanent position. And I'll talk a little bit more about this when I talk about the vision for the East Campus. But this vice president for health sciences and biomedical initiatives is a critical, important position to help us really consolidate all the things that we have in place now in the health sciences and where we're trying to grow in the future with collaboration with other hospitals and medical schools and pharmacy schools, et cetera. So that is also kind of a temporary position. And we are, it's not a search that's ongoing. We've actually identified someone, but we're not prepared to announce that publicly yet. But you'll be hearing about that in the next week or two.
Okay. Thank you.
So we're very, very excited about that. So let me move on. As I alluded to earlier, we're very, very pleased to have the latest member of this new class of administrators, Joe Brennan, who's the Vice President of Communication and Marketing. Joe is with us today, and you're going to have an opportunity a little bit later in the program to hear from Joe. So say hello, Joe. And so maybe it might be helpful, Michael, at some point if we can have people introduce themselves. Joe's been.
Why don't we do that? Mark, why don't you start?
I'm Mark Benson. I'm the athletic director. I started September 10th of 2014.
Okay, I'm Cynthia Fox. I'm a faculty representative, and I am outgoing on this council, and I will be the Senate chair.
Jim Jackson, council member.
Robert Bellachander, council member.
Pat Caldwell, council member.
Abner Jean-Pierre, council member.
Steve Bettis, retired vice president for finance and business and liaison to the council.
Emphasis on retired.
Emphasis on retired.
Nick Butler, undergraduate student representative.
Joe Clancy, council member.
John Fell, council member.
Mike Jeslong,
council member. Jim Januszewski, graduate student representative.
From the phone is Joseph Garba, the Alumni Association president.
Chantal Cleary, head of line coordinator. Nancy Lorenzola, executive director of community theaters. Carol Sweet, serving as interim CIO.
David Rousseau, dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity.
Jim Stoller, provost.
Alice Oldfather, assistant to the president for strategic communications.
Jerry Hyde, deputy chief of staff.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So, Joe, these are the folks that we work with very closely to advance this mission, and I think you're going to enjoy hearing briefly from Joe about his perspective of how communication and marketing is going to fit into moving us forward. Just want to provide just a minute to give an update on a process that we implemented. We did a version of it my second year here. My first full academic year, and then when we brought Jim Van Voorst on as the Chief Financial Officer, he's spent a lot of time and effort streamlining the process, laying out the criteria for the process, and actually implementing what I think is an important management tool, particularly on the how we can seamlessly link our strategic planning at the individual unit level with our budget allocation process, so that as a leadership team, we have a better understanding where there's strategic opportunities across our collegiate units and academic support units. And it's also shown the view of the way that Jim has structured this is providing an opportunity for units to find ways to collaborate much more effectively. The first iteration of this, we received proposals. They were individual, isolated proposals. This is what I want to do for my unit. That was little or no collaboration or discussion with other units that may or should be involved or engaged. The compact budgeting process, the way that we've implemented on the Jim and the rest of the leadership team's engagement, is proven to be a very good process because it provided an opportunity for all the places across the university to inform us of some of their strategic ideas that they can put on the table for consideration for recurring or non-recurring funding, but also provide an opportunity for collaboration. And also it's an opportunity to tell us about significant financial needs where there's a financial crisis brewing out there that we may not know about, and it provides an opportunity for us to intervene before, you know, it becomes a big or a major issue. And so we're in the midst of piloting the process, the revised process this year, and we will be pushing forward for the rest of the next few months to make those budgetary decisions and looking at how we will be able to make some investments in these strategic ideas that I think is this whole compact budget planning process is very, very important as we think about a new way of operating and a new way of more systematically connecting strategic vision to the budget process and how we spend our money. And also how we, it's not just about asking for new investments. This is also the process because it's tied to looking at each unit's budget so we can have a better understanding of how we're spending the resources that they have. We are, have a better sense of how they utilize the meager investments that we made last year And so it's going to be one of the principal financial management, plan management, and tools that we use to continue to increase the operation of this university. So we'll be reporting back to you probably by the time of our next meeting to give you some sense of how much was invested in some of the key areas that were critically important that we invested in. So I just wanted to make you aware of that.
Quick question. Do the various, you know, units or schools or whatever the units are get to see each other's?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
It's one of the things I think we agreed to Jim insisted on, which is, you know, I've been around this process for a long time.
Let's hope it fosters collaboration.
It didn't have that kind of opportunity. But we're saying it's almost, I think it's true to say, every one of the proposals had some level of collaboration with it.
Well, okay. Well,
yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, and we're... You remember how many we received? I don't.
280 or so, about 60% of them. There was a line on the form where it said, who are you collaborating with? And I think the applicants felt that if they filled that out, they'd have a stronger proposal. So it just naturally engendered it, and it was really rewarding, frankly, to see the efforts that they made across silos.
Good.
Okay, we'll move on here. What I'd like to do now, the rest of the time I have, is just to kind of briefly walk you through kind of a reframing of our strategic initiatives. We still operate around the four stakes that I talked about during my first year here. But in terms of how do we advance that strategy, we're starting to talk about this in the context of the following initiative. One, since Jim Stella arrived and we hired Michael Christakis as the Vice President for Student Affairs, we're starting to see a lot of collaboration between the academic side of the house and the student affairs side of the house. And also, it provided an opportunity for us to really start to think differently about how do we do a better job of making sure each and every graduate of this university, at the undergraduate level in particular, in this case, comes out of here with such an amazing experience that they will go back to their communities and they will tell two friends and so on and so forth, because I fundamentally believe, folks, that is the best recruitment strategy you can have. We can't hire enough recruiters to do that better than the students that graduate from this university. And so we decided that rather than just quietly doing things on this front, we are framing it as one of our core strategies. And we're framing it around this broad umbrella of enhancing the undergraduate experience, which has a number of different components. Is the strategy under which we will do a better job of enhancing our enrollment, increasing our enrollment. I talked to you the last time about the challenges we are having with enrollment over the last 7 years and the strategies that we put forth in that. I'll talk a little bit more about it in a moment. But it also is, under this strategy, is going to provide an opportunity for us to be a bit more strategic and intentional about our retention strategies as well, because it's one thing to continue to bring in an increasing new freshman class, but there's some opportunities to do a better job of retaining the students we have, particularly from first to second year. Our retention rate's now about 81%, and on the national scale, that's pretty darn good, but it's not sufficient. We can do better. The institutions that we aspire to be comparable to, some of them have first to second year retention rates, 91%, 92%. It's a number that Jim Stella, our provost, has kind of set, and I think it's a goal that if we implement some of these strategies, we can clearly get there. So as I said, because of the work that we started about a year ago, we came to realization that we were on a continual downward spiral of enrollment on our first year students. We became more strategic about that. And so this year, it appears that we are going to be slightly up from in terms of our enrollment. And when you consider the new academic programs that we're going to be bringing online, we project that we will see over the next few years an incremental growth in our undergraduate enrollment, which is the path that we should be on. And our Student Affairs Office and Academic Affairs Office are teamed up really strategically on what we call some high-impact practices, such as enhancing our summer orientation program, expanding the living learning community for our undergraduate students, and they are also implementing what I call a data-driven strategy or early warning system that allows us to track and provide an early warning when students are not on course, when they're not demonstrating the behavior or when they're demonstrating behavior that research shows means that they are likely not to come back to second year. If we're able to, we've already implemented a system that's going to allow us to collect that data and be very intrusive in terms of, you know, students are not like most of us sitting around this room who get a little nervous about being tracked. Students grow, they've grown up in this environment, it's no big deal to them. Other universities have implemented this strategy with great results, such as Arizona State and Georgia State. They're the two universities now that for the last 2 years, other places have kind of become the model for the rest of the country to kind of emulate in regards to using a data-driven system to really help provide early intervention for students that are not on track to for graduation or not on track to come back to the institution second year. And so we're very excited about this. That's clearly going to enhance our ability, I think, to improve the undergraduate experience and improve our graduation rates. Robert, and it's going to help with recruitment as well.
Is this purely academic, or is there some other that they follow besides just how the grades are?
Part of it is the system will allow us to determine whether or not Johnny enrolled at UAlbany in August of 2015. We will know whether or not Johnny has gone to football game, has never swiped his card to go to the rec center. Yeah, so it's all that out of classroom stuff that we know that if a student is not engaged in outside activities, that's one of the signs that they are at risk of not coming back to this university the second year. And we're investing more resources in those out-of-classroom activities through a student fee that we implemented last year that's going to provide more late-night programming, more activities to keep students on campus. Because one of the things that's painful for me to watch every Thursday and Friday is to watch the massive exodus of students that get on buses and go to Manhattan or someplace, I don't know where, Boston. And what I hear from them, well, there's not enough to do around here on weekends, so we leave. And so we're working on all of that to really enhance the undergraduate experience. So it's both academic and out-of-classroom activities we're focusing on. And to help with this as well, we're enhancing facilities. As you know, you go over to the campus center, and I can tell you, I think I'm fairly intelligent, but I tried to navigate to get down to the food court a couple of times this summer, and I gave up. But progress doesn't come without a cost, and we are expanding the campus center to provide more room for students, more student space, and the East Addition will open for the kitchen and dining operations this semester. That was the first addition that they started on. The West Addition is on the way. I think if you go over now, you see steel going up. And that's scheduled to open in early 2017. And at the same time, the old or existing portions of the center will be undergoing some renovation as well. And that will open along with the West Addition next year. So we're very, very excited about this. Another aspect of enhancing this undergraduate experience that we decided about a year and a half ago to look into moving beyond what we traditionally do to welcome new students, which was basically a candle lighting ceremony. That's very much a part of the tradition, both for new students and for graduating students. We don't want to lose that tradition, but I just thought we needed to do more on the academic side, the same kind of pomp and circumstances we have at graduation. How do we introduce students to this community with a big bang? To show them that they are important, opportunity for us to lay out very clearly institutional expectations of them as students, and get them and their parents excited about being here and letting them know that they made the right choice by sending their students here. So therefore, we're on Saturday, August 2nd at 4 p.m. at SEFQ, we will be having our first opening convocation for our new students and their family and friends, and so we invite all of you. If you have time in your busy schedules, this is a newbie for the University of Albany, and we invite you to come and participate as well. Now, just to move to just a quick update on the strategic initiatives. Originally, we thought we would have a memorandum of affiliation to be discussed and hopefully approved and vetted by this body. We are making great progress as it relates to this memorandum of affiliation with Albany Law. But we're not quite ready to bring that to you at this point. So the Mr. Chairman, we may have to have a conference call or something depending upon the timing, but our goal is to execute this memorandum of affiliation, the first of at least two affiliation agreements we plan to execute to move this big idea about affiliating with the Albany Law School ahead. We're still very, very excited about this, and I can tell you it's generated a lot of excitement, not only among our faculty, staff, and students, but also at Albany Law as well. We think that this is a big idea, it's a transformative idea that will help expand the academic profile of this university by adding a very important, very critically needed professional program to our mix of academic programs. So we are very, very excited about that. And part of the excitement is how this is going to help redefine legal education, the way that it's delivered at this law school, and the way that it's going to link seamlessly with the opportunity for students to not only get a law degree, but also to get a degree if they want to, that's tied to business and to maybe public policy or some other aspect of what we do well at this university, because there's a lot of indications that that's the kind of training that folks in the legal community are going to be looking for in the future. And so we're very, very excited about what we're doing there.
What's your thought on timing?
At this juncture, we hope to have a memorandum affiliation ready to go somewhere between the end of September and the middle of October. So we're making good progress in that regard.
It's tough negotiating with a bunch of lawyers.
Yes.
That's a setup there.
I'm going to watch from both sides.
I'll take the bullet for you.
We'll just move on. Actually, we've been having great fun at these meetings.
Yeah,
because people see this energy, and I can tell you, there's a lot of excitement, even though we know that there's a lot of obstacles ahead of us, but there's a lot of excitement about this.
Being a graduate from both schools, I think it's a great idea, Sam.
I appreciate that. And so the other thing I'd like to talk to briefly about, and I know I won't take too much time on this because Provost Stella and Dean Rizzo are talking to you about the new College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity. And David has created a new acronym that's a bit easier to say.
Accepting.
Yeah, and he'll tell you a little bit more about that. But this is, I can tell you folks, this whole area, based on the conversations I hear in the community, folks outside of the academy, outside of this university, are starting to get very excited about the potential of this as really being something that's transformative and another key addition to our efforts to expand the academic scope of this university. So I'm just going to leave it there. We've made a couple of key decisions, and one is to co-locate this new college, hopefully on a tract of land that we're trying to negotiate with the governor's office about, and move and build both of these facilities on the Harriman campus. And so we're still under negotiation and having conversations with the state about doing that. So we're very excited about that as well. You also may be pleased to know that as of July 1, the College of Computing and Information is no longer. We now call it the College of Engineering and Applied Sciences. This is the name changes official. We have a new chair of the new department that we're still trying to get approved through State Ed, which is the first program as part of this new configuration, which is computer engineering. We're very pleased to report that Kim Boria, former head of computer science, I think at RPI, is the new chair and also the interim dean of the college. We hired, Jim, I think, three new faculty members last year. And so you're going to be hearing a lot more about this. We're going to make a big deal about it once the students and the faculty return, because, well, this is a big deal. This is probably one of the biggest things that's happened to this university in a long time. And we just don't want to quietly implement this strategy. We're going to be making a big announcement about it, because I think it's important for us to send a message, not only just internally, but externally, that this university is headed down a different path. And that a public option for engineering in the capital region is something that's in everyone's best interest, not just you all. We're working on a strategy that will locate the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences initially in the old Albany High School, the Schuyler Building. I think I talked to you about that before. Provides an opportunity for us to do some amazing things with the city of Albany, that underserved community that's going to get more students from underserved communities, hopefully interested in science and engineering. That's going to be a gut renovation, and I know some of you kind of gasped the last time we mentioned that, the cost probably associated with that, but we still think that that's going to be the best use for this facility that we now own. And so we're working with the city of Albany and others, communities, to get them involved in this as well. So we're very excited about this. Then the other strategy is the East Campus. As I said earlier, we're exploring different mechanisms to bring all of our disparate pieces of our health sciences initiatives together and to really start thinking about that East Campus. It's a valuable asset. I think all of you have been there at some point. But it's an asset without a very cohesive strategy. And so that's why we are in the process of identifying someone who's going to come in and to work with our provost and the VP for research, the Fardines and I, and the foundation about crafting a compelling vision for that East Campus that's going to kind of rebrand it and kind of repurpose it and bring all the pieces together to create the synergy that I think is necessary to move us ahead. So please stay tuned. You're going to be hearing more about that. Just like to end by just giving you a few updates on government relations activity. You notice that's one of the areas that we completely restructured last year under the leadership of Sheila Seary and Robert Lee Sangerwal. They've made a very, very significant progress in aligning our position, creating relationships that we need to get access to legislators on the second floor to advance our agenda. And folks, this office is absolutely critical. If you don't have the ability to get your message to the legislative body and to the governor's office in a very timely fashion, in a very compelling way, it's very hard to move your agenda and get support from our legislative process. And in a very short time that these folks have been involved, we're very pleased to vote them. The last legislative session, we secured a center of excellence for our Department of Atmospheric Science through the support of not only Assemblymember Pat Fahey, but also Senator Amador. Is that right? Did I get that right? His support was absolutely critical, as well as to Pat Fahey's support. And as you know, with the transition of NANO, we didn't have a center of excellence. And so now we do, and we're very excited about this, particularly because it supports advancing the work of our Atmospheric Science Department, which is one of our largest and most well-known departments at this university. Parallel to that, we're also pursuing a Center of Advanced Technology for the RNA Institute, which, again, we're the only university center that does not have one of those as well. And so we're making great progress. So anyway, I just wanted to highlight.
Could you explain, just for my edification, what does that mean? You say we're the only one that didn't or doesn't have it. What there's some special designation of the center. What
it's a special designation with legislative support, roughly about $1 million. Buffalo, Stony Brook, and Binghamton East have at least one of these. Some of them have two. And when NANO transitioned as a part of New Albany, we had two at one point, but we lost them both when that college separated. And so we used that as part of our argument, but that was a fair today. The compelling reason is the outstanding and innovative work that the atmospheric science folks is doing, you know, the MESA network that the governor assigned us to do, as well as the work that the RNA Center. So
and that carries with it a funding stream.
It carries with it a funding stream for the Center of Excellence for Atmospheric Science. I think we got $250 for the first year, and then we plan on going back getting as close to full support. Actually, most of these are funded as close to $1 million, most of them $900,000+. And so we plan to go back and ask for full support, as well as getting this other one. This is important more than just from a symbolic fashion, folks. This really is important. important in terms of providing the resources on a recurring basis that's going to be necessary to help support the work and advance the outstanding work that goes on in these two research centers. And since we're sitting there at the only so-called research center and didn't have these two important buckets of funding, so we've made significant progress, and we're fairly confident that we're going to get this Center for Advanced Technology for the RNA Institute, and as well there's some additional NIH money that we're going after for the RNA Institute as well.
Right.
And so we're really planning to, and you have to invest in the areas that stand the biggest potential of advancing the university, particularly to help distinguish us from the rest of the pack.
Do centers have to be renewed every year?
It's not an annual renewal, but in this next round there were three or four of them that were coming up. The money is not guaranteed forever. Ultimately, you have to come up for renewal, and it's kind of a mystery to me in terms of how some of these decisions are made. It's not very clear, but the notion is I think they were going to be 10. And so which means if we put in an application for one, then somebody has to drop off. And so it is quite competitive. So the fact that we were able to get this at least initial designation for the atmospheric is a big deal, because that means that somebody else is going to get bumped eventually. But I think it usually is about a 10-year commitment that you have before you have to defend yourself, which is good. Yeah. So it's a good strategy. I talked about Joe, so I'm going to move on for that. The next big thing I'll just close with is, we've talked about a lot here. There's a lot going on. The university implemented a strategic planning process probably some 7 years ago, maybe. That strategic plan is one of the first things I looked at when I came here, and I was quite impressed with how comprehensive it was. It was so comprehensive, I think my first response, this is a beautiful plan, but we can't print enough money to do all of this. And so we're at a critical juncture now where we will be looking at that old plan, because it's probably at least 2 years out of date now. And kind of juxtaposing that against what we've been verbally articulating about where this university is going. And mapping out a process to get each and every one of you, the faculty, the staff, members of the community involved, and the next iteration of that plan that will be built on how do we bring the more contemporary, recent strategic initiatives we put in place in a revised plan that will clearly provide an opportunity for folks to be engaged and bring greater clarity about where we are and where we're going. And so that's going to be one of the things that's going to be occupying a lot of my time and my staff time, particularly Jim Stellar and the rest of us over the next academic year. How do we step back now and start to work on implementing a new strategic planning process that's going to help really bring all this together in a very transparent way? And that's where we're going to be depending on Joe to help us use that whole process and all the things that we've been talking about to tell our story more effectively. Think about how do we rebrand this place to get people excited about, first of all, knowledgeable about what we're doing, and excited about where we're going. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. Great.
Questions? There's an awful lot going on. Anybody that's in the area certainly hears it, sees it, feels it. I work very closely with Robert in his economic development activities. There is a buzz around and about this university that has not been felt in many, many, many years. So I think it's fantastic, and I'm sure those of you that are outside of the area are certainly feeling the ripple of that wave, maybe not as intensely as you do here in the Capital Region, but I'm certainly feeling it. Any questions or comments? No? All right. Well, Joseph, it sounds like you're up. Robert has queued it up for you. We're excited to hear from you.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate the time to talk to you this morning, and I really appreciate the opportunity to join this winning team. It's great to be back in New York State. Tell you a little bit about myself, tell you a little bit about what's drawn me to the job, and then maybe a little bit about what I think the work is ahead. I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, so I'm sorry, but I can never be a Yankees fan. It's not a great
start of presentation.
It's not great being a Tigers fan either. And I came to Buffalo for my graduate degree. I was in the PhD program in English there, and I left with a degree and my wife. So my wife and I are both SUNY alums. Spent my career, although I trained to be a researcher and teacher, I spent my career on the administrative side of what we do, and worked at different kinds of schools in different places in the country, and then got recruited to come back to Buffalo. This would be about 8 years or so ago, and spent 6 years there. And one of the things that I did was to develop the message strategy for the what at the time we called the UB 2020 plan. That kind of became the basis for SUNY 2020. And it was really wonderful because I saw the community and the university come together and team up to do amazing things that had a huge impact on the economy of Buffalo, third core city in the nation. So it was very exciting work. After we sort of achieved that goal, President John Simpson retired, and I stayed for a couple more years, went looking for new challenges, went to the University of Iowa, way out on the prairie, and was there for a couple years, but felt that call to get back, especially with my wife's family in upstate. So this, when this opportunity came along, I had to answer the door. Explore it, and you know what I noticed right away is your ambitious vision and the way that the university community has united around that. There's tremendous support, growing momentum here, and that's very attractive to somebody in a role like mine. I also noticed the very high quality of the academic programs, and I will say from the perspective I had 350 miles down the road, I think Albany's reputation perhaps is not quite commensurate with its actual quality. And I think the work that my team will be doing in conjunction with all of you is to close that gap. I think Buffalo and Stony Brook maybe, you know, got out ahead of that a little earlier than Albany and started putting some things in place. But I know that our agenda is to catch up and then perhaps even surpass in terms of what we're doing here. And I think that strategic, thoughtful communication is essential to do that, because with good communication, we build awareness, relationships, trust, and ultimately support. We have to think across all of the different objectives and audiences of the institutions. There's a lot of complexity involved in this. It's not perhaps quite the same as branding a commercial product or service. It's really about constructing that very compelling narrative with everybody's support and buy-in so that we can really stand out and draw people to us, whether it's recruiting students, generating alumni support, philanthropy, athletic support, political support, all of it, I think, very broadly. I also have work to do, my team and I, on what I call playing defense. If building the brand and telling the story of the university is playing offense, we also have to play defense, and that means helping find problems and bring them to helpful resolutions before they become issues, crises, things that eat away at the reputational capital of the university. So getting ahead of our bad news, dealing with it in a forthright way, I think is part of the work as well. Starting on Monday, I'm going to need everybody's help and support. I'm going to spend a lot of time getting to know the institution, its programs, its people. I want to get an extremely deep personal understanding of the place. I think that will help me a lot. I'll also be looking at all the research that we have. Will develop a process for kind of crafting that narrative and developing that strong and authentic positioning statement in collaboration with all of our campus stakeholders, alumni, faculty, students, this council, community members. And then implement and then measure and adjust and sort of, you know, lather, rinse, repeat from there on. Did they take any questions or hear any perspectives we might want to share today? Caitlin.
Are you at least a Bills fan?
Absolutely.
What was that?
Is he at least a Bills fan?
Yes.
He can't be a Yankees fan.
I am a Bills fan.
All right, well, I'm good.
Sorry. Just can't do it.
No, it's not that it's the whole Detroit. You said Detroit, right?
Detroit.
Yeah, so Detroit. Pistons, the Bad Boys. But you're on probation for a while.
I
don't know.
I can see I'm getting off to a good start.
I would say more importantly, Detroit and Buffalo haven't exactly, you know, had stellar reputations in terms of just overall prosperity. So I don't want Albany to turn into Detroit or Buffalo.
I'm thrilled that you're here. I thank you. The best steps here, and I think it's a really good position. In building the brand and then making sure that inside the institution, that every interaction that anyone has with the institution exhibits that brand. And I think when we do that and when we pull that curtain back, I think that the potential is really significantly more than the experience today. So I'm thrilled that you're on board. I think it's fantastic.
There's phenomenal quality here. It really is.
I was just going to say welcome again. I know you haven't started, but and I trust certainly from your background that you'll certainly do your interviews or discussions and meet with all the other stakeholders in the university. Communication and marketing, you know, the worst. It's about knitting everything together and understanding the interests of everyone and being able to protect that. So, you know, I know the president and the rest of the people behind us, we're really happy you're here. Can't wait till you start, and we're going to get you a Yankees hat. And I've already, you shouldn't have said that because I already have a couple of things in the back of my mind here to try to onboard you, if you will, properly. You're welcome. Good luck.
I, of course, will second all that. I think one of the biggest challenges that I've seen for several years now for us has been really with the media. I mean, the local paper, big challenge. And as well as even, you know, cultivating, you know, the New York Times and people like that. And there's actually a big article on Albany in the New York Times this past weekend. And I think really, though, the starting point is probably with the Times Union. We never seem to get in the Times Union, and I'm not a regular reader, it seems, except for sports or somebody has screwed up somewhere. And so I think in coming up with a strategy, you really need to think about managing the Times Union, because all the legislators and so forth read that, and as well as, you know, perhaps the New York Times in terms of getting out the message to downstate. Just good luck with that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Because I think they're big challenges today.
Yes. Well, having worked with the Toledo Blade and the Des Moines Register, I'm not afraid of the Times Union. I'll build relationships there. And I agree with you. I think earned media is very important. It's still influential. Despite what you might have heard, the news media industry is not dead. There's more readers than ever. Well, the economic model is shifting. And I think starting at home is always a good idea, because those are the folks that are going to know you the closest. And when you have a crisis, they're going to cover you right away, and what they say will have a big impact on how the rest of the nation understands that story. So there's a lot of advantage in investing.
You just really need to develop a good relationship with the people there and feed them and get to know, you know, really. It's something I'm not sure we've always done in the past.
We haven't paid enough attention to the Times Union, I think, in the past. And although I think in the past there's kind of been this really, truly adversarial relationship between, I'm just telling it the way I see it, the university and the Times Union. We've made some progress, but I can tell you we are not where we need to be. We've had two meetings with the editorial board, and by all indications, based on what I've heard from people on that editorial board, they are very excited about what we're doing, but they weren't so excited that it precipitated the storm, which we were. Am I right, Seth? I don't want to mischaracterize this. We had two very good meetings with them. And in fact, I've heard by the grapevine that one of the comments were they weren't quite sure where this universe was going, but it seems like we're on a very exciting path. But there was never anything written about that in their paper. You know, that would have tremendously helped us. And so, I guess to be succinct about it, the relationship is better than what it was, but we still have a lot of work to do.
A lot of ways to go.
Got a lot more work to do.
We're going to shower them with information, friendship, and...
Well, and the nice thing today, though, is that having been a victim of this, people are getting their interaction with the news in a whole bunch of different areas. So you have all kinds of other things available to you that may pull them back into the group. There's only so much time on the average you can spend. You know, I think you have to try it, but there's so many other avenues now that people are accessing. Their news and the happenings and what's going on. And, you know, I think that you touched on one of them, and that's the students and our grown students and our alumni, you know, getting into that social media component. You know, I think that can go a long way to offset if you can't get older on the fact the standard. But the channel is clear, and we're excited to have you for it.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much.
We'd like to move on to our, and I'm anxious to hear the new acronym, the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity. That's a mouthful.
Good morning.
Morning.
So about, six months ago, Provost Stoller asked me to take over and help set up this new college. And it's a great, exciting opportunity. We've made great progress, but we're only a couple months old, so there's great amounts of work to be done. It really began in 2014 when Governor Cuomo and his State of the State said he wanted a new SUNY College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity. But he didn't say where it was going to go, and there was a lot of discussion. Should it be on a SUNY campus? Should it go to a private university? And a lot was at stake for the University at Albany. We have a lot of great work in public health preparedness, homeland security, cybersecurity, and the vision of the state investing millions of dollars in another campus to compete directly with us was something that it gave us all pause. And the president and his staff and the government relations people, Sheila Seary, did a great job in persuading the governor that Albany was the place to put this new institution. And so in the most recent State of the State in January, the governor announced it was going to be at UAlbany, put up an image, and there was a building with UAlbany's logo on the side. And you know, beginning with that speech, we've been working to create a vision for the new college. Part of that is going to be weaving together these assets that already exist at the university. I could tick off a long number of them, but the School of Public Health has a graduate certificate. The School of Business has digital forensics, as I'm sure you know. They have a graduate certificate in information security, a new MBA concentration in cybersecurity. Informatics at the undergraduate level has a cybersecurity concentration. Rockefeller has a concentration at the MPA. Master's of Public Administration, as well as a certificate. So there's a lot going on at the university in different pieces. What we want to do is weave that together. We want to be able to get some additional resources and invest in that college and build it out. The governor has given us $15 million, and President Jones mentioned we're hoping that it'll go into the new building on Harriman, which is a great location for it, right near the Division of Homeland Security Emergency Services, the State Police, the Emergency Operations Center, but also adjacent to our campus and walking distance. And what we want to do at this point is persuade the governor that operational funding should come along with that, that in order to have first and the best institution in this area, we need the state to invest in us. And I think over the next few months, that's the great challenge for President Jones and his staff, as well as myself. The vision of the college, once it ramps up, is a college of 15 to 20 faculty members, about the size of the School of Criminal Justice here. We're hoping to have 200 majors, get a master's program up and running, have certificate programs. And in terms of these academic programs, we've already begun. The college itself has been established. CEHC is the acronym. You have to have four digits for university code in the system, and that's what we have. But this college is established. If you click on academics up there and schools and colleges, it'll come up, and our new website is up there. This spring, in about 2 months, we got a minor approved. So at UAlbany, you do a major and a minor, an 18-credit minor, six courses. We've created four courses, an introductory course, a cyber course, a homeland security course, and emergency preparedness course. Those are all up and running. We have 12 students now officially declared as our minors, and that will grow. We hope to about 100 students. We're working on the major right now. We have a committee of about 50 faculty members who've been participating in it. We've drafted it, and we're ready this fall to begin putting it through governance, bringing in external reviewers to comment on it. Once it's approved on campus, it'll go to SUNY administration, then to state ed. If all goes well, and keep your fingers crossed, fall of 16, we hope to be getting majors into the program. Graduate programs is the next sort of piece of business that we're going to work on this fall. We're certainly going to think about the master's program and where do we see demand. Is it in the homeland emergency preparedness? Is it in cyber? What do we want to line up first? How do we work with the other College of Engineering Applied Science as well as the School of Business on that? We have begun to do hiring. President Jones and Provost Steller has approved four new faculty members for the college. Most of them will have joint appointments in other units. However, it's critical that we have a critical mass within the college. It can't just be joint appointments and everything done with a little bit of money here, a couple classes there. Really, if we want a high-quality undergraduate graduate program, we have to have faculty dedicated to making sure that it is top-notch. And in closing, we have sort of seven principles that we're using to drive the college forward as we're building it. But one of the key sort of themes here is that we, want it interdisciplinary, so it's not just going to be in one unit. We want public health professors, computer engineering professors, we want business professors, social welfare when they do work. In the area of mental health and disaster mental health. So it's really got to be an interdisciplinary effort drawing in on all the schools and colleges across the university at Albany. It's also going to connect to other academic institutions. A good example of this at New Paltz is they have a disaster mental health program at the graduate level. It's known throughout the state. It's highly regarded. And so what we're working with them is to integrate those courses into our program. So they could take some of them online. They're going to help us develop some of the baseline courses that you need. And so we're looking for collaborations, and we've been talking with Buffalo, Maritime, Canton, and others to try and reach out to them and see what they're doing and not duplicate what they're doing but become partners. Empire State College is another one. They have a homeland security program. They'd love to team with us, and we've been working to think about if we offer this set of courses and you offer this set online, our students are going to have a much broader array. That's going to help us bring new-to-program students to this campus, and so I think these collaborations are important. And the final set of collaborations are with state agencies as well as with the private sector. Private sector with cyber, that's a huge growth area. I mean, you can't open the paper without having another crisis, both in government and in the private sector. And so we see the private sector is important throughout, but particularly in the cyber area. We've been meeting with state agencies, Division of Homeland Security, Department of Health, Office of Mental Health, Office of Child and Family Services. All of them have key areas related to the new college. All of them want to participate in some way, take our students, work with us in capstone classes, give us research questions for our faculty. And so over time, as we build those relationships, we want to institutionalize them and have them be real partners in this relationship. And a good example of this is fall, and every fall we're planning to have a setting an agenda in Homeland Security, Emergency Preparedness, and Cybersecurity, bringing in our state and private partners, sitting them down and saying, okay, this is what we've done in the last year. Where do we want to go? What research questions are you interested in? And the state agencies are very excited about this. They've lost a lot of that research capacity over the last couple decades, and here we can team with them and help fill that void and become real partners. Again, they'll be hiring our students, taking our students as interns. It's a real opportunity for us to match the classroom learning with that experiential learning in terms of internships, research, et cetera. And so we're excited about the new college. We're just a few months old, but I'm happy to answer questions now, or if later something comes up, or if you visit our website and it raises questions, I'd be happy to chat with you about it.
Questions? I've got one for you. You were kind enough to present to us. Unlike most other disciplines that are within the university system, where there is a body of learning that I don't want to say is fixed, but it is even more stable than cybersecurity. Cybersecurity changes by the day. How do you integrate those two things, the need to be current and the need to have an institution? How do you put those two things together?
Yeah, in the area of cyber, I think what they're... you'll find is that the set of skills and knowledge that our students need in order to combat cyber is a solid foundation. And then every day, the attacks evolve, et cetera. To me, it's sort of like public health, right? You can arm people with the tools necessary, but each flu comes in, it's a different one, and they have to go out and say, okay, here's the new threat, here's how we're going to actually identify it, create a vaccine, and distribute it. And so, I think it speaks to not training students to a particular type of programming language or skill, but training them to be lifelong learners, right? And so it might shift entirely, and right now using certain skills is what you need, but in 3 years, or in cyber in 1 year, you need a new language, you need a new way to approach this. And if you're lifelong learners, that's going to be easy for you to do. And I think in the College of Computer Information, that's sort of been their philosophy, and going forward, I think in the cyber area, that will be as well. It relates also, I think, to the broader question. Sociology has a corpus that everybody learns and is relatively stable. In all the policy areas, I think it's slightly less. And this area is very interdisciplinary, so it's not like where I envision this new college to have its new corpus. I think you draw on public health, you draw on criminal justice, you draw on digital forensics in the School of Business. And so, looking 50 years ahead, is this going to be a discipline in every college around the country? Probably not. But like in many interdisciplinary programs, it's going to draw on the expertise and the foundations in other areas. And so I think it's slightly different in two ways, but I think looking at the newspaper, between climate change and extreme weather, cyber and ISIS, these issues are not going to go away. And training the best possible students and getting them out there working with us is critical.
Certainly from the private sector, that need is it's an unquenched thirst for us to have the resources.
David, could you just comment, to lead into what you just said? I think a lot of times people don't really understand fundamentally how this the fact that we need a college like this within itself is kind of an unfortunate situation. But given that reality, what are the rationale for why we needed to do this and why you needed to bring all three of these pieces together is that you can imagine with the state of the world affairs today, with what's going on abroad and what's going on domestically, the cyber attacks, et cetera, it's generating a very large demand, my understanding, for jobs. I think the number is something like 300,000 jobs a year for now into the future, just to kind of stay on top of this from a workforce perspective. And that's an unfortunate statistic, but it's a reality, and it really does drive home the point why such a college is needed. And I was really struck when we had our first conversation with the folks from Homeland Security back in D.C. in the spring, and I think this guy was a deputy director, I don't remember exactly his position, but he basically made the comment about post 9/11, you had a bunch of people who weren't all that necessary tech savvy, older folks that were forced to come together to try to figure out, how do you start to mitigate some of these issues, and that it was very, very clear that the path going forward was going to need young people with innovative ideas and innovative approaches in order to mitigate some of these issues. So there, it's in many ways it's unfortunate, but it's the reality that we live in, and it really does make this opportunity very strategic and absolutely critical that we do it right, because a lot is depending upon our ability to really pull this off in ways that we articulate and even beyond that. So
I was just to put a caboose on both of their statements that I think this is phenomenal. It's great to be in the beginning because you have so much flexibility. You can look to the past, but then look to the future. Just to pick up on what Michael said, the private sector is huge. And I know it's difficult sometimes for the academic to make the jump to the private, but go big. I mean, this is like the banks, the CFQs, the JP Morgans, yeah. The Googles. You know, throw stuff out, because I know one of the issues, and I worked in government, with Homeland Security, it's police. And police, they have a different, law enforcement has a different mindset. They're protective than always being so collaborative. Now, things are changing and so forth, but I think being the fulcrum of this, of kind of dealing with the law enforcement communities, and then balancing that with what the private sector needs are, I think that you guys are poised to be right in the middle there, getting back to the market communication. I mean, this is one, run with it, because there's so much stuff there, but congratulations and good luck.
Yeah, I agree entirely, and we've been working a lot with the business school because there's lots of areas of growth. You think about business continuity of operations, supply chain management. You know, we live in a complex global world, and if you have just-in-time manufacturing, you make yourself vulnerable to all sorts of disruptions, and how do you train people in terms of risk management to manage that? And so this school, I hope, is not going to send all of its 200 majors into, you know, being emergency managers or work for the state. I would expect a lot of them are going to go into the cyber area, into the business world, and have those risk management skills to be able to navigate what will be a challenging future.
Great. Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
We want to do a quick update on the Upstate Revitalization Initiative, again, to refresh your memory. Among his other full-time jobs, Robert is the co-chair of the Regional Capital Region Economic Development Council. And as part of that, there is the Upstate Revitalization Initiative, which is the $1.5 billion competition that will allow three of the seven upstate regions to get an award of $500 million. So there's an awful lot of work going there. Robert, I don't know if you want to touch on it. So we have a group that is working. We have come together and hired McKinsey and Company. We felt that if we were going to do, if we were going to compete effectively, we needed to bring in someone who could help us to do that. Interesting that this whole topic of education, which McKinsey has identified as one of our strongest assets in the region, and the issue of cybersecurity, which has been one of the areas of biggest opportunity, has been independently identified by them as something that we should look seriously at in the capital region. So we have walked through this process of stakeholder engagement, going out and talking to people and individuals, groups, companies that are here, companies that aren't here, that should be here, to do thought farming, again, but completely data-driven, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to use McKinsey and Company, that whatever strategies we come up with and the initiatives that support those strategies must be data-driven. It can't be something where we have a gut feel or, boy, wouldn't it be nice to increase this or decrease that. It has to be driven by the data that supports the asset and supports the opportunity. So that's what's happening as we speak. By the time we're done with this, which will be an official submission on October 5th, we will have a submission to the state that tries to paint a very compelling future for the region based on specific investments that the region needs to make. We are hopeful that we win that $500 million that can help to advance those initiatives, but if we don't, the plan will still stand on its own and serve as a guidepost to get us through, to take the region to tap some of what we believe is unprecedented potential in all of upstate New York. So an awful lot of work is happening. The president is doing an enormous amount of work. He's going to be off to Buffalo because in the state there's an official due date and then there's another due date. So people have been summoned to Buffalo to give not their whole plan, but to give the update of their plan, and I think that's happening next week. So we have to be very artful in talking to the governor. The governor will be there to talk to the governor about the process we've gone through, but we really don't want to play our cards yet. So you know, the slide deck, which happens to be right here, is going to be very interesting for that presentation. But it has been an awfully exciting time. I think there's a lot happening. We have pulled people off the sidelines to say, yes, I want to be involved in this, both in thought farming, but also in funding. Because for those of you that know McKinsey, they don't come cheap. So we are, you know, the price tag for this is somewhere between $2.5 and $3 million. But I think it's a great investment, and we're well on our way. So I'm happy to take any questions that you may have. But you can expect that the University of Albany is going to be right in the center of what comes out of that report.
What's the timeline for the awards?
They want to do the awards by the end of the year. So it's really fast-tracked. And it's real money. Unlike some of the other economic development programs, this money came from all of the fees and assessments of the financial services industry, primarily in New York. So it's not tax credits, it's not any of the other creative programs that they have. This is actual money, economic development funding that we will get in the region. So $100 million a year for 5 years. So it can certainly, if invested properly, change the direction of the region.
Great.
Okay.
I'd just like to just add this one piece, because it has been one of the outcomes, and I think the critical outcome of this whole process, and it's something that if you ask the mayor, she will repeat this almost every time when she's asked about it, but it kind of came up as a part of the SIAC tour that we did early in the week. And one of the things that's already happened as a part of this process is something that, as a relatively newcomer to this region, I felt we definitely needed to do more of. And how do you move the conversation around strategies that would really advance Albany or Schenectady or Troy individually to a more collective conversation about what's good for the region? So I can tell you from my perspective, that alone, if we can continue to advance that mentality, that mindset, that a strategy that just focuses on one of those metropolitan regions, or areas without thinking about it from a regional perspective, is never going to get us to where we need to be as a region. So I think we've made significant progress in that regard, and that's one of the things that we're going to be emphasizing as a part of this process as well. Because unlike Buffalo, you know, where you have a major metropolitan area around which you can rally all of your strategies, here, a lot of what we do might be done in the Tri-City region, but it has to be done in a way where everyone sees some benefit from what we're going to be investing in. And I think we've made a lot of progress in that regard, which is something that would not have happened had not it been for this process.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, it wasn't too many years ago that literally a call from Schenectady to Troy was a long-distance phone call, literally. And unfortunately, people have acted that way for most of the intermediate years. This process has pulled people together and put them at the same table, and I think just that process alone has been worth the effort so far. Great. The revision of the student code of conduct.
Good morning, everyone. So we're back again. We were before you last time, so thank you, and we apologize for having to come back again. To make yet another set of changes to our student code of conduct. Chantal Cleary for everybody missed it earlier. As everybody is aware, probably from the resolution we sent out and because it's all over the papers, the New York State Legislature passed an amendment to the New York State Education Law by adding Article 129B. on June 14th, and Governor Cuomo signed the law into legislation on July 7th of 2015. This law addresses universities' responses to sexual violence on campus. It's been nicknamed the Enough is Enough Bill, and we're here today to ensure that we're in compliance with the mandates of that legislation by amending our code of conduct prior to the effective date of the law, which will be October 2015. We've made some very, very minor changes because the law was crafted off of the SUNY policies, which this board approved changes to the code in line with those policies in April. I do have the changes to the code color-coded and on a thumb drive if you'd like me to display them. I didn't know if everybody wanted me to do that or not.
I don't think we've seen a copy of them.
No, you haven't. It was a really large box, so we didn't send it.
Can you do a high level?
Yeah. Can you just at least tell us
through
what they are?
Sure. So what we did was we changed some definitions in accordance with the law in Section 2 of the code. So we have the most pressing definition change was our affirmative consent definition. Again, very slight changes to what the definition was in our previous code that you saw in April. The changes basically just make the code, the definition, a little bit shorter and more succinct. And this code is required to be part of, or this, these definitions are required to be part of our code now by the piece of legislation. We also changed our definition of sexual assault 1 and sexual assault 2 in our code to be consistent with the federal definition of rape as required by the legislation.
Can I just interrupt for a second?
Sure.
So it's apparent that we don't really have the flexibility because the legislation itself dictates what we have to do.
That is correct.
So we can talk about all this if you want.
No, I just wanted just a high level. It's not, I mean,
it is what it is.
I remember, Mike, I'm just saying that I don't really think we have the ability to say, oh, I don't really like that definition and I think we should change it. I think we should just say that we have taken under advisement that we have done what we had to do to amend the code, and we're simply we're approving what the legislature has asked us to do, and we are complying with the legislature, and something we have no real flexibility on or choice to do. Is that an unfair comment?
No, and I think it's better stated than the perception that we actually reviewed and approved the policy, which we did. I'm more comfortable saying that we have.
That's what I'm getting at.
Right, that we have followed the guidance that we are mandated to follow, as opposed to this being a deliberative body, which we weren't in any way should be.
And I think the record should reflect that.
I agree.
Because if there's any litigation later, I want it clear that none of us had any direct input into the language, but you were simply under advice of counsel making these changes in association with what's in the legislature, the legislature, as opposed to, you know, the prior thing, which was our own views of what the code should change. Right.
That's correct.
I think you're right on target. I think it should be very clear.
One thing, though, I think we might want to spend a couple minutes on, and that is not of what you said, but on the idea of how do we make the student body, how aware are they of this? Because that was actually what the article in the Times was about this weekend, and they had a reporter waltzing around the campus center here, and and of course, a number of the students were unaware of the law change and so forth. And so what we should be focusing on is dissemination and education, you know, as opposed to...
Do the students every year sign something that affirmatively says that they received and have a copy of the code of conduct?
The students, we distribute a link. Nancy Lorisella, Executive Director of Community Standards. We email all students at the start of the school year to remind them about human rights responsibilities and any changes or any updates that have been made. At any time that a change would be made to the code, we would notify students.
If
And I can also tell you that.
I'm just saying.
Do they pay attention? Do they read their emails though?
Those emails are.
Our job is to make sure.
Okay.
Right. That the communication has been disseminated.
But those emails are drowned out. We get an email every single day.
I understand, but Pat has correctly pointed out that how are we communicating effectively in the best way we can to the students?
I mean, I think the answer to that is no. Right. I think we're meeting the requirement of what we need to do, but I think there's more that we could do so it's more clear.
So the question is there exactly a better way?
That was my point. That's crucial that you give to them. And that's one of the problems you have when you have a big university, because you put them in large groups. That's difficult, and you can't way you'd like to go.
Steps are being taken in the orientation. I know is changing this year. That steps are being taken. That it is changing. So I know that there are steps being taken to address that.
I guess I'm new here. I've been here for going on my seventh month now. And one of my primary responsibilities is education and prevention. And I can tell you that fortunately these changes were made prior to freshman orientation beginning. I have personally been participating in every single freshman orientation, transfer orientation, and student group orientation, athlete orientation. I'm meeting with every team individually to explain the changes, not only in our code, but also other policies and our efforts to prevent sexual violence on this campus. This summer alone, I've actually reached personally close to 3,000 students. So we're out there. We've developed a new website to get this message out. We've just launched an awareness and prevention campaign, so we're working on that. And it's one of my primary goals.
This is what we're talking about, because we essentially have a job to approve this. But I think our separate job is to ensure that the project is being implemented correctly and adequately and all that. That's what I'm getting at. And I think I brought this up the last time in front of us, remember? And we just want to make sure, because this is the only area that I get a little concerned about, especially as to what our responsibilities are.
Sure.
I think you, too, there's no question you have to get it to the student. You also have to get it to your staff, too. They have to be aligned and being provided with the same information. This is something that has to be done. Everybody is involved with this, because if they're communicating back and forth with the student, they have to make sure they have the right information.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to see on
the click list, and it can't be the iTunes. I agree. You know, I'm agreeing to 40-page disclosures, but
Mike, for example, what I was saying.
My son is both at Drexel, but now he's going to the University of Colorado Boulder. They are required to sit through a very specific orientation on this topic, and then they have to physically say, I did it, I understand it, I've acknowledged it, so that somehow there is a transfer of the obligation that we have done what we were supposed to do, or at least partially what we were supposed to do. So I'm not telling you how to do your job, I'm just suggesting that if there is some way that the student that can actually acknowledge that they have received and understand the information.
See, that's really the only area that I think we care about. When I say care, I mean that we can have an impact on. Mm-hmm. The rest of it, it's the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We are looking into purchasing online training platforms that address these issues. We're trying to find the ones that the students can't cheat through, so we're meeting with outside vendors, and at the conclusion of those trainings, and we're thinking about making them mandatory, so before your SUNY card gets effective, before you return for the academic year, you'd have to go through the training process, and you would have to check off that you've done it. So we are actually put a request in collaboration with Academic Affairs and Student Affairs for funding for that, and we're very close to having the vendors start to go through the process to get approval through the state.
Mike, I think it's fair to say that we would support that.
Oh, absolutely.
That's the one area that we would definitely give our views on.
How are the other schools, as best your knowledge, other universities, are they addressing this? Kind of like what John was saying, is anyone else out front?
I think the private schools. This is brand new to them. The state schools, the SUNY schools, have been dealing with these policies since December of last year. Almost the exact same set of policies or requirements. So there's a lot of kind of frantic scrambling, a lot of calls from the private schools. How do we do this? How do we handle this? I will say that I think UAlbany is way out in front of this issue. We're the only school with an advocacy center for sexual violence focused only on responding to sexual violence. We're, as of yesterday, we are now two of 64 SUNY universities that have a full-time Title IX coordinator reporting to the president. Prior to yesterday, it was just us. So I think our response and our planning far exceeds what some of the other schools are doing. And I think we can see that in the fact that I'm getting a lot of calls from our schools saying, how are you doing it? Can we have your materials? How are you getting your message out? So I see us kind of as a leader in this issue. Does that answer your question?
No, that's good. The bottom line is, just taking the legal speak off, it's like we want these kids, and as everyone in this room does, I'll speak for everyone, you know, it's hard enough being a kid as it is going to school, and I have added another issue that maybe artfully drafted, maybe not, it's still a fact pattern that they're going to have to deal with, and the more information they get from whatever source, airplane throwing stuff out, and they pick it up in the campus center, or whatever,
RAs,
SA, you know, whatever.
Doing that today, actually.
You know, I think there's a way to...
The consequences of...
Infiltrate the community.
...an appropriate understanding of this policy changes that student's entire life.
Yes.
Yes.
So they need to understand that.
Our actions have to reach their level.
That is why our preference is an in-person training. But we are, you know, utilizing, understanding that we have a student body of 17,000 and a staff of, you know, 3,000 or 4,000. We understand we can't reach everybody face-to-face, but we're doing our best to reach as many people face-to-face and supplementing where we can't reach face-to-face with other types of materials, trainings, events, and awareness.
I have a thought, just, you may not like this, but conditioning any of the SA groups receiving funds and do it before they get the check, hey, you guys have to do a different type of training. I mean, I don't know, I'm just being creative.
Part of the legislation requires that in order for a student group to be recognized, to receive funds, to be chartered on our campus, that they go through a training, a one-on-one in-person training on this topic. And not only the policies and the code, but also what they can do to prevent sexual violence before it happens. So we've developed a curriculum that other schools are now kind of taking from us to do that, and the same goes for athletes. Student athletes cannot participate in their athletic program until they've had a in-person training with somebody on this topic.
So not to make your life more difficult, and certainly I can shout it down on this, but from a board governance perspective, I think it would be helpful maybe at our next meeting, which you just did just the communication aspect. This is how we communicate, just so that we can say as a board that we have done what we should do with respect to the governments.
That. Michael, that's really the only due diligence that I think we need to do.
Right.
Everything else is pro forma, so we have no...
And I just want to say, my comments weren't to say that we were failing at doing this. It's just that it's inherently difficult to communicate this to students, especially students who are already here, who we went through. You know, I went through an orientation that says no means no, and that's the complete opposite of how they're trying to teach it now.
Well, to your point, this is taking students that, fortunately or unfortunately, since the time they were 12, operated under a completely different
sure.
set of rules.
And it needs to be clear that it's no unless yes.
When you are 18, the rules just change.
Sure.
There has to be that very clear communication. I don't want to belabor this one, too, and then we'll move on.
I guess I have one sort of caution and then a question, and the caution has to do with, I mean, it sounds good to offer more training and all of these things, but it is such a serious issue that we need to be really careful about how we implement those trainings. I know the training you're referring to for student groups, and student groups had 6 days' notice and were told that their funding would be wiped if they didn't show up, and a lot of the groups didn't even have new executive boards yet, so a lot of people ended up just throwing whoever could go to the training there, and we don't want people just arriving at these trainings going, I have to do this for my student group. I understand attaching it to the money, but we have to make sure that the students are taking it seriously. And so that was a huge problem in the Graduate Student Association. Most of our groups don't elect new boards until the fall. So they said, how can we do this at all? Are we all going to lose our funding? So that was, I think, just very poorly executed from the perspective of the Graduate Student Association. Just in terms of the messaging and understanding actually the way student groups work, I think most student association groups have their boards by that time, but so that was more of just a caution, I think, for the whole board as we think about being more aggressive in communicating these things, but understanding that it's so serious, it's not just about hitting people with the message, it's about making sure they receive it. So that's my caution. Then my question is, I arrived here as a graduate student 5 years ago, so I don't remember if I got some sort of message about community standards and the student code of conduct. I don't know that graduate students are given the code of conduct. I know we don't have an orientation, despite the fact that the Graduate Student Association has asked for an orientation. We apparently have some sort of online thing on MyUAlbany that I just found after 5 years of being here. So my question is it consistent the way that we message to graduate students and undergraduate students?
My understanding is yes.
All students.
All students. And I think going back to the training that you just brought up, I agree with you. And because of that, it was too large of a training, and so now we're making it some smaller. But you know, we are in a situation where we're having all of these laws kind of placed and policies very quickly. It's changing, and what we're trying to do is be in compliance with it. But you're absolutely right. It's more important that the message gets across than us.
I just want to very quick. She's precisely what I wanted to say, and I think that, your student leaders, student organizations can be extremely helpful to you at this point. There are some things that are extremely serious, and some things you can do whatever. This is critical, and I think that they should have them to step up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any
I think we reflected it in the minutes.
Oh, I've got it.
What we were looking for. All right, so that was the consensus of the board. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, I have the only thing that stands between you and a sunny Friday afternoon are a couple of council resolutions. Our first resolution is for Bryant Barksdale. Bryant is not here.
He started a new job yesterday, so he sends his apologies. But
so we were successful. So
we'll mail it to him.
Right to resolution, and I would look for a motion that resolves that in recognition of his services as the graduate student representative, the council expresses our gratitude for his active participation and leadership, and be it further resolved that the council extends our best wishes to him in all of his future endeavors. Is there a motion?
Motion.
Second. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Professor Cynthia Fox, whereas you have served as the faculty representative to the University Council for the 2014-15 academic year, and whereas in that position you have effectively represented the instructional facility, faculty, and professional staff of the University of Albany, thus facilitating the work of the council and meeting our statutory responsibilities under Section 256 of the New York Education Law, and whereas you have offered important insight and counsel to the University Council on a broad range of issues brought before the body for consideration and action, and whereas you undertook this assignment in a professional and responsible manner, now be it resolved that in recognition of your services as the faculty representative, the Council expresses our gratitude for your active participation and leadership, and be it further resolved that the Council extends our best wishes to you as you assume your duties as the chair of the University Senate for the 2015-16 academic year. Motion made and approved unanimously?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Nick Butler.
I'll do a motion to skip the reading.
What are you trying to tell?
I appreciate it. But let's save us all the time.
So moved.
And I need to at least read the resolution.
That's right.
Resolved in recognition of your service as the elected student member, the council expresses our gratitude for your active participation and leadership, and be it further resolved that the council extends our good wishes to you as you continue your studies at the University of
Alabama.
Entered as a unanimous motion and approved accordingly.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
This one you're stuck with, okay? this is for our retired, on again, off again, Steve Bettitz, whereas you have served effectively and efficiently as the secretary to the University Council since your retirement in 2013, longest post-retirement ever. Whereas in that position, you were invaluable in assisting the council in meeting our statutory responsibilities under Section 356. Whereas you provided a direct channel of communication for the members of the council through your position. And whereas you have served the university in leadership roles, including Chief Human Resources Officer for 20 years and as Vice President of Finance and Business through your retirement. Whereas you have also served the SUNY system as Director of Employee Relations and Personnel Services. Whereas you have performed these assignments in an exemplary manner with tact and confidentiality. And whereas your wise counsel, loyalty to the university, work ethic, and collegial way have endeared you to your colleagues, it is therefore resolved that in recognition of his services as secretary, the council expresses our gratitude for your dedication and notable accomplishment of your duties, and further resolved that the council extends our appreciation and good wishes as you step down as secretary to the university council.
Now listen, a lot of that stuff is debatable.
Yeah,
you may want to discuss it.
Steve drafted that.
This was snuck in.
Wait, what? I didn't write that.
I'll make the motion, but if you all want to
amend the motion.
A friendly amendment draft.
It's great.
Well, thank you.
So moved.
Thank you.
Seconded and approved unanimously. Thank you for everything you've done for the university up to this point, but you're not done yet because the hooks are still in, so you can't hide.
This has been one of the most gratifying assignments I've had, so it's been my pleasure to be closely involved with you since I took that vice presidency job on and then succeeded Sorrell as secretary. So it's been my privilege. It really has.
Thank you.
It's great.
And to make sure that we have someone to continue to fill this very vital role that Steve has been filling for the last several months, we've asked J.D. Pike out of my office, who's the deputy chief of staff.
He was the only one in the office.
Deputy head, and taking all of this responsibility. So I wanted to make sure you had a chance to meet J.D. He's already been working with Steve over the last several months and is part of this transition.
Be nice to him. He's just a kid.
I was going to say, yeah, I mean, after Sorrell, who was whatever, 89.
That's how we got that
role. Yeah, Sorrell was, I think, 89.
Is there any business that anyone wants to bring in front of the body?
One point of order. Robert learned this week that for the September meeting, which is scheduled to start on the 25th at 2 o'clock, he has been called to a president's meeting downtown, but he can make it by 3. So my suggestion is that
it's not downtown, it's in Saratoga.
Oh, okay. Can you make it by 3?
I'm going to have to leave early to be here, so if we could move it to 3 o'clock, it allowed me to get back rather than trying to find a different day.
That would be much easier from my experience.
Okay,
thank you.
Any other new business? A motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Thanks, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your summer.
Thank you. 3-1, early double.
Good luck.